139. Psalm 139, fearfully and wonderfully made. In many ways, this may be the greatest pro-life passage in all the Word of God, for it makes it very clear that even before our mother knows that we have been conceived in her womb, God is aware of every particular detail about us. It is also a psalm that wonderfully exalts the crucial attributes of God in terms of His omniscience, knowing everything, His omnipresence, that He is everywhere present, and also His omnipotence, that our God is all-powerful and He can do anything. And so it's a magnificent psalm. In many ways, it's almost the pinnacle of the Psalter. And so let me read for you tonight, beginning with verse 1 all the way to the end of the chapter of verse 24. O Lord, You have searched me and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thought afar off. You comprehend my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word on my tongue, but behold, O Lord, You know it altogether. You have hedged me in behind and before and laid Your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. Where can I go from Your Spirit? Or where can I flee from Your presence? If I ascend into heaven, You are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, You are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there Your hand shall lead me, and Your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall fall on me, even the night shall be light about me. Indeed, the darkness shall not hide from You, but the night shines as the day. The darkness and the night are both alike to You. For You formed my inward parts. You covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise You, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are Your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from You when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed. And in Your book they are all written, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there was none of them. How precious also are Your thoughts to me, O God. How great is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would be more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with You. Oh, that You would slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, You bloodthirsty men, for they speak against You wickedly. Your enemies take Your name in vain. Do I not hate them, O Lord, who hate You? And do I not loathe those who rise up against You? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them as my enemies. Search me, O God. Know my heart. Try me and know my anxieties, and see if there is any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? What's it all about? These are just a few of the questions that we call the ultimate questions of life. And these are questions that accompany us. Indeed, some would even say these are questions that haunt us all of our lives. Indeed, we follow up with questions like, do I really matter? Does my life have a purpose? If God exists, does He know that I exist? And if He does He even care that I am here? And does He even care that I exist? To all of those questions, Psalm 139 responds with a resounding yes. God is there. God knows all about you, and God cares deeply about who you are and what it is that He has laid out for you in terms of a perfect, particular, specific plan for your life. This psalm links us to God in a very unique way. In fact, few other texts link us in exactly this same way. Indeed, this God who is said to be omniscient, verses 1 through 6. Omnipotent, verses 7 through 12. Omnipotent, verses 13 through 18. And omnicompetent, verses 19 through 24. He has fearfully and wonderfully made us, verse 14. Indeed, He has fashioned all of our days before we were even formed in our mother's womb. Verse 16. Psalm 139 was clearly penned by King David. And as I just read it, I think you probably saw even initially that it divides naturally into four stanzas of six verses each. It's very clear in our English text. It is really something of a composite psalm because when you look at it, you discover there is located in it a hymn, a praise song, thanksgiving, a lament, confession, meditation, and even a prayer. And it very much has the characteristics of a teaching or a didactic psalm as well as a wisdom psalm. It's trying to give us wisdom as to how it is that we can live a life wisely, recognizing we have been fearfully and wonderfully made. The word that drives this particular passage is the word "no." It occurs no less than six times in verse 1, 2, and 4, verse 6, verse 14, and also verse 23. And building his psalm about our being fearfully and wonderfully made, building his psalm around the attributes of God, David would want us to know that this God who has made us knows everything. This God who has made us is everywhere. This God who has made us can do anything, and this God who has made us will deal with everyone. And David knew, as you and I must know, that wrong ideas about God will inevitably lead to wrong ideas about who we are. Let me say that again. Wrong ideas about God. If you do not think correctly about God, you will not think correctly about who we are as human beings. And indeed, David knew that such wrong thinking can tragically lead to wrong decisions, leading to the wrong path, and tragically, as the end of the psalm indicates, resulting in the wrong destiny. Indeed, David wants us to know our God so that we may also know accurately ourselves. The great theologian of the Reformation was John Calvin. His most famous books are his Institutes of the Christian Religion. And in chapter 1, paragraph 1, book 1, John Calvin said this, and I quote, "Nearly all the wisdom we possess, that is to say, true and sound wisdom, consists of two parts. First, the knowledge of God, and secondly, the knowledge of ourselves." And indeed, he could have been summarizing Psalm 139 because Psalm 139 is built around the knowledge of God, resulting then in a knowledge of ourselves. And so what is it that Psalm 139 teaches us about our God and ourselves that we need to know and that we need to never forget? Number one, we are made by an omniscient God. Stanza 1 affirms a simple and basic truth. God knows all about you. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You see, with spiritual x-ray vision, God peers not only at your body, God peers into your soul and He sees you and He sees me for who we really are. You may escape the glaring eye of others, but no one escapes the x-ray vision of our God. Indeed, the text intimates and makes clear that God is never surprised. God is never caught off guard. Putting it in context, God was not caught off guard about what took place yesterday. And God is not caught off guard about what is going to take place tomorrow. God knows everything, past, present, and future. He knows all things actual and all things potential. In fact, one thing God would never say is, "Wow, I didn't see that coming." That may be true of you, and it is certainly true of me, but it is never true of our God. Do you note the powerful verb action that you find in this first stanza? Do you see it? "You have searched and known me," verse 1. "You know, you understand," verse 2. "You comprehend," literally, "you winnow and are acquainted," verse 3. "You know altogether," verse 4. "And you have hemmed," or "you have enclosed me," verse 5. And so David wants us to understand specific things that this omniscient God knows about us. And so he delineates 4 areas in particular where the omniscient God looks at you and looks at me. And as one man said, I believe God would say, I know you so well, I know you until it hurts. And so what is the first thing that God knows? Well, God knows your heart. He knows your character. Verse 1 again. Oh, Lord, you have searched me and you have known me. This is a convicting truth. It's also a comforting truth. God knows me inside out. God knows me exhaustively. God knows every aspect of who I am, including the secret parts of my soul. In fact, in your notes, I note that many of us have what could be called soul secrets. These are things we keep hidden from others. In fact, some of us are so good at it, we can even keep it hidden from those closest to us. Some of you, perhaps this evening, here tonight, have some soul secrets that even your mate does not know. After all, they cannot climb up between your ears and peer into your mind and see what is going on inside of there. No, there are some things you can hide that are in your mind. There are some things you can hide that are in your heart from those close to you. But though you may be able to hide it from your mate, from your children, from even your best friend, these things are not hidden by God. God knows every thought you've ever had. God knows every emotion you have ever felt. He has searched me and He knows me. Charles Spurgeon, that great Baptist preacher in London of a previous century, said it this way: the Lord knows us thoroughly, as if He had examined us minutely and has pried into the most secret corners of our being. Our heart, our soul is nothing less than an open book to our God. Yes, God knows my heart. Secondly, God knows my actions. Verse 2. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thoughts afar off. You comprehend my path and my lying down. You are acquainted with all my ways. Yes, God knows your character and God knows your conduct. The you here is emphatic. You and no one else knows me in this kind of a way. David uses a figure of speech here, or uses a phrase that tries to set opposites in contrast to each other that then encompasses everything in between. I know you're sitting down. I know you're rising up. And the intimation is, and I know everything else in between. So I know when you get down. I know what you do throughout the day. And I know when you lie back down and get up. I know it all. Nothing about you escapes my knowledge. Our daily activities are completely known by God. In fact, he says there in verse 3, you comprehend my path. You comprehend my lying down. You are acquainted with all my ways. But now go back to verse 2. It gets worse than that. Indeed, you even know my attitudes. And you know the motives behind my actions. You understand my thought. Verse 2. You understand my thought afar off. In other words, distance is no barrier to God. He has microscopic knowledge, microscopic vision of everything you have ever done, everything you will ever do, everything you've ever thought, everything you will ever feel. God knows it all. He knows what you do, and even worse than that, He knows why you do it. You see, that's something you might not even know. Your heart, like my heart, is deceitful. It is wicked. My heart can fool me. I can't always be sure of my motives. I try to the best of my ability. As Paul says, I look in. I don't think there's anything here that I'm doing out of an impure motive. But Paul says, you know what? Bottom line, I don't know me that well. I'll just have to trust God to pass judgment later when I stand before Him. And so the fact of the matter is, God is concerned not only with what you do. God is even concerned with why you do what you do. In other words, you and I may do some good things, but for the wrong reasons. We may fool others. We don't fool Him. He knows your heart. He knows your actions. But it's number 3. He knows your words. He knows your conversation. Verse 4. For there is not a word on my tongue. But behold, O Lord, you know it. And in fact, you know it all together. David would say, even before you say it, He knows it. And He knows it exhaustively. He knows it completely. He knows it altogether. You and I, in an unguarded or angry moment, may blurt out something that is foolish or hurtful. Again, I'm at the top of the class when it comes to doing things like that. Afterwards, I looked at myself and I said, you know, what were you doing? I never planned to say that. That even surprised myself. Sometimes our clutch between our brain and our tongue becomes defective. In fact, for some of us, it burns out. So we think it, we say it, and boy, do we wish we could stick it back in there. But no, once it's out there and gone, it is out there and gone. But again, though it may have surprised you, it didn't surprise God. He was not caught off guard in the least. He knows your heart. He knows your actions. He knows your words. He knows your destiny. Verse 5, verse 6. You have hedged me behind and before. It could be translated enclosed. And you have laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. God knows your destiny. That is, God knows your course of action. He knows your course of life. In fact, the text says He has surrounded, and the ESV says He has hemmed us in. The New American Standard says He has enclosed us. He has enveloped us by His love and by His care. Now you say, but Danny, the words love and care are not in there. Why would you say that? Because of the last phrase of verse 5. You have laid your hand upon me. In fact, you ought to mark that phrase there in verse 5 and note that it occurs in a similar fashion again in verse 10. Even there, your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me. In other words, it's very clear that the child of God is in view here because it is God's tender hand that is laid upon His child as He hems him in both on the front side and also on the back side. In other words, David is saying, this God of mine hems me in and guides me. This God of mine hems me in and He comforts me. I can't escape Him. I can't get away from Him. But then David, I think, would say and raise the question, why would you want to? Why would you try to get away from a God who knows everything, and He's about to tell us, is everywhere? But furthermore, why would you try to get away from a God who cares for you in this loving, tender, fatherly, kind of a way? And in fact, I think David would say, I don't want to get away from Him. And the fact that I know I can't get away from Him, the fact that I know I can't fool Him, verse 6, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, and I cannot attain it. In the Hebrew text, the word wonderful is in an emphatic position. It's actually at the front end of the verse to strengthen its force. It would almost be wonderful. This knowledge is too much for me. Could be translated extraordinary. Could be translated surpassing. In other words, David would say God's divine omniscience, that God knows everything about everybody, is simply too high for me. I can't get there. I can't go there. This kind of knowledge blows me away. It is beyond my wildest imagination. And he says, can you believe it? You and I are made by this kind of omniscient, He knows everything kind of God. But now, secondly, we're also told in stanza number 2, verses 7 through 12, that we are made by an omnipresent God as well. When I was a little boy, one day I went off with some friends, just on a walk, three or four of them, and they took us down to a creek where there was some water running, and so we were down there hanging out, and I lost completely any track of time. As we got through messing around down there as we had, we were walking back toward the house when we met a search party of about 10 men, and they were out looking for us, and in particular, they were looking for me. When I got back to the house, I found a very angry and a quite hysterical mother who then commenced to inform me of her anger up close and personal, wearing my backside out. It hurt my backside, but it broke my heart because I truly did not think I had done anything wrong. I was going off with some guys that I always hung around. I assumed that she knew where I was and knew what I was doing. And so after receiving that up close and personal attention, I went into my bedroom, climbed into my bed, and put the covers over my head to hide. Later, my mother comes in there, and of course she sees the bump in the bed. And she walks over and she pulls the covers off and says, "What are you doing in there?" And I said, "Well, I'm hiding from you. Why are you hiding from me?" And I began to tell her, "Because you spanked me and I didn't do anything wrong." And of course, then we died. But anyway, I came to realize very quickly that though I thought I could hide from my mother under the covers, she saw me. She knew where I was. And she was going to get back involved and give me her attention. Well, I'll tell you something. If a mother knows her little boy's hiding in the bed, what do you think God knows when we try to hide from Him? That is even more vain, even more foolish, because though we might be able to hide for a while from a parent, we cannot hide at all from a God who is everywhere present. Look at what it says there in verse 7. "Where can I go from you, from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, oh my goodness, you're there. If I make my bed in hell, in Sheol, behold, you're there. If I take the wings of the morning and or dwell in the uttermost parts of the earth, even there your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me." David wants us to understand, first of all, in verses 7 through 10, God is with us, or with me, with you, with all of us, wherever we may go. Verse 7 basically utilizes two rhetorical questions that anticipate the answer, nowhere. Where can I go from your spirit? Answer, nowhere. Where can I flee from your presence? Answer, nowhere. It's a beautiful example of Hebrew parallelism as the two questions complement and reinforce one another. Well, verses 8 and 9 use two pairs of hypothetical opposites, which again include everything in between them. He says, look, go up to heaven. If I do, you're there. Go the other direction. If I make my resting place, and it's actually the Hebrew word Sheol. Some of you will even have a translation that says Sheol. The word Sheol can be used in different ways. It can mean the grave. It can mean the place of the dead. So either idea, I go up to heaven, you're up there. I go down into the grave. I go down to the place where the dead go. You're there. Up and down, everywhere in between, you're there. Well, if I can't go up and down, let's go left and right, or east and west. So he says, what if I take the wings of the morning? He's talking about the sunrise in beautiful Hebrew poetic expression. So I take the wings of the morning. I go east at the speed of light. Or if I go west and I dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, which west of where David would have been the Mediterranean. So if I go east to the sunrise, or I go west out into the depths of the Mediterranean, doesn't again matter. East or west, up or down, you are there. And again, because he has this tender relationship in view that he wants all of us to enjoy, he concludes the matter in verse 10 by saying, even there, your hand shall lead me. God will give you direction. And even there, your right hand shall hold me. God will give you protection. So anywhere and everywhere I might go, you are there. And furthermore, you are there with what is best for me in your sight. So God goes with me wherever I go. But God also is with me wherever I am. Look at verse 11. If I say, surely the darkness shall fall on me, even the night shall be light about me. Indeed, the darkness shall not hide from you, but the night shines as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to you. What is he saying? Well, he said in verses 7 through 10, distance cannot separate me from the omnipresent God. Now he says that darkness cannot hide me from his presence either. In other words, turn off the lights. Pull the drapes. Close the blinds. Pull the covers over your head. Darkness may allow you to conceal yourself from another human being. In fact, many of us play that game all the time. But the bottom line is you can never hide from this God who knows everything and this God who is everywhere present. Indeed, David says, what is dark to me, literally and spiritually, is always light to Jehovah. Indeed, I like what the Puritan preacher Stephen Charnock said about trying to get away from this omniscient, omnipresent God. Listen to what this great 17th century Puritan wrote. How terrible should the thoughts of this attribute be to sinners? How foolish it is to imagine any hiding place from the incomprehensible God who fills and contains all things and is present in every point of the world. When men have shut the door, made all darkness within, to meditate or commit a crime, they cannot be in the most intricate recesses, be sheltered from the presence of God. If they could separate themselves from their own shadows, they could not avoid His company or be obscured from His sight. Hypocrites cannot disguise their sentiments from Him. He is in the most secret nook of their hearts. No thought is hid, no lust is secret, but that the eye of God beholds this and that and the other. He is present within our heart when we imagine, with our hands when we act. We may exclude the sun from peeping into our solitudes, but not the eyes of God from beholding all our actions. And yes, we are made by an omniscient God. We are made by an omnipresent God. But now, number three, we're also made by an omnipotent God as well. I mentioned at the beginning that this could be accurately called the pro-life psalm. Why? Stanza number 3, verse 13 through 18. For you formed my inward parts. You covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame, literally my bones, they were not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your books they were all written, the days fashioned for me when as yet there were none of them. How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How great is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would be more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with you. Jeremiah chapter 1, verses 4 and 5 are a wonderful commentary to Psalm 139. There the prophet writes, "Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you." In other words, God saw us, and God loved us before He made us and as He made us. Omnipotence now begins to be the artisan. And omnipotence begins to knit us together in the dark, in the secret place of our mother's womb. Even before she knows that she is pregnant with you, even before my mother knew that she was pregnant with me, the Lord was busy shaping and forming me there deep in the recesses of her womb. Furthermore, not only was He making me in my mother's womb already, He was laying out the particular details of my life. In other words, David wants all of us to know this evening that God cares about our beginning. That's verses 13 through 15. And God also cares about our future. That is verses 16 through 18. First of all, God cares about our beginning. The Lord formed my body. Note the connecting word that begins verse 13, 4. It is looking back and making a connection with the first stanza, verses 1 through 6. The second stanza, verses 7 through 12. In other words, this omniscient God and this omnipresent God is now the omnipotent God who is making me. Now look at the words there. You formed me. The you is again emphatic. You and no other formed me. You created me. You made my inward or inmost parts. It's actually the Hebrew word kidney But they would use the word kidney to talk about the inner person. Sometimes the inner soul, sometimes the inner physical person, but who you are on the inside. God was even in the business of forming that as well. To say it this way, body and soul, you made it all. You formed me. And then the New King James says, you covered me. Some translations say, you wove. You knitted. In other words, God was involved in the intricate details of your life like a skilled craftsman would knit a piece of cloth or weave a beautiful basket. God is knitting you, and God is forming you, and God is bringing you into existence. Now listen to me. He is bringing you into existence exactly the way He wants you to be. In other words, you're not taller than God intended. You're not shorter than God intended. Your eyes are the color He planned. Your hair is the color He planned. The lack of hair you have, He planned. He planned it all right? Down to the last detail, God was involved in knitting you and forming you in your mother's womb. David just all of a sudden has to break out in praise. This is more than he can handle. And so what does he say there in verse 14? I will praise you. Why? For I am fearfully and I am wonderfully made. David says, I look at this in wonder, amazement, and reverence. What God does inside a mother in her womb is nothing less than a magnificent creation on the par of what you would find in Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2. Indeed, David sees the works of this great Creator God as marvelous. The ESV says it is wonderful. In fact, he says there in verse 14, my soul knows it very well. I have absolutely no doubt either about the Creator, nor do I have any doubt about the tiny creation in view. Brothers and sisters, what is in there inside the womb of a mother is nothing less than a tiny human life. The only difference between that little embryo inside of the mother and you and me is size, location, and age, and that is it. Size, we're bigger than they are. Age, we're older than they are. And location, we're out here, they're in there. But other than that, there is not one whit of difference between that little tiny baby and you and me. Once again, David brings together the theme of God's omniscience, now linking it to God's omnipotence. And he says there in verse 15, my frame, literally my bones, they were not hidden from you. You see everything. You know everything. Indeed, they were made in the secret, in the hidden place within my mother. They were skillfully wrought, the ESV says, intricately woven. Eugene Peterson, in paraphrasing it in the Message, said it this way, quote, you know exactly how I was made bit by bit, how I was sculpted from nothing into something. And Chip McDaniel, who teaches over at the seminary, says that you could translate this word wrought here as embroidered. Embroidered. And he notes that the same word is used about the needlework that was used to construct the tabernacle and the needlework that was used to describe clothing in the book of the Exodus. And so again, like a seamstress would carefully knit together a sweater or a piece of cloth, God was carefully knitting together all the little details of your life. Now, the next phrase kind of throws us off, doesn't it? It says there that you, indeed, verse 15, skillfully wrought me wherein the lowest parts of the earth. But again, remember, we're in the Psalms. The Psalms are poetry. And it is simply a poetic expression that is talking about the fact that God made me in this hidden, dark, secret place. Just like you can't see what's going on in the deeper parts of the earth, you can't see what's going on in the deep, hidden part of a mother's womb either. Indeed, we may not know all that's going on. We may know more than we used to with the advantages of sonogram machines. But the bottom line is, even with the sonogram, your knowledge and my knowledge of what is happening inside that mother's womb is so small and insignificant, it cannot be compared to what God sees And it cannot be compared to what God knows. No, the Lord formed my body. And if you're not happy with your body tonight, take it up with God, not your mama, not your daddy, because God was the one putting you together exactly the way that He did. Yes, He formed you, but also He foreordained your life. Look at what He says there in verse 16. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they are all written, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them. You see, God saw you at the moment of conception as an unformed substance. That's what the text says. But even when I wasn't much, I was still something to Him. In fact, He pre-recorded and laid out in advance all of my days. Look at the text. God, number one, wrote all the details of my life in His book. Secondly, He fashioned and formed all the days of my life when none of them yet even existed. In other words, God had a plan for David from the very beginning. From the very beginning to the very end. Was God caught off guard or surprised when David was conceived? No. Was God caught off guard and surprised when David died? No. David, like you, like me, like all of us, had his life laid out in minute detail from the very beginning to the very end. That's why I love what Lottie Moon said in writing in her letters back to the Virginia Baptist. We are immortal until our work on earth is finished. Nobody can take your life. Nobody can remove you from this planet until God chooses to bring you home. He has a plan. He establishes the length of life, the specifics of life. God has a perfect plan to the last detail. David, once again, can't handle it. So he says in verse 17, how precious are your thoughts to me, O God? How great is the sum of them? If I could count them, they'd be more in number than the sand. When I awake, I'm still with you. Now, that's a little odd. So I tried to write my own paraphrase for you to try to get at what I think he's saying. Here we go. Your thinking of me down to the last detail is so very precious to me, my God. The vastness and the greatness of their total is so great that they are more than every grain of sand on the earth. Trying to count them all exhaust me, and I fall asleep. Yet when I wake up, you are there. As you are every day of my life. Now, a little footnote. As I was preparing this particular study, a couple of the men that I read said that, you know, when he uses that phrase there, when I awake, I am still with you, may mean more than just waking up from sleep. It may have in view the waking up following the death of a believer. So that when I wake up out of the sleep of death, what does the text say? I am still with you. And you know, I begin to think about that. In the New Testament, on a number of occasions, the death of a believer, and only the death of a believer, is sometimes described as sleep. Why? Because for the believer, death is simply closing your eyes and then waking up in the next moment in the presence of Jesus. That's a cool thing. That's a wonderful thing. That's a marvelous thing. And the older I get, the more I look forward to that particular thing. And so David is simply perhaps saying here that when I fall asleep in death, because of the promise of resurrection that's for all of us who know Jesus, I recognize that to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. The God who made me is the God who has saved me. And so death for me is not a tragic thing. Death for me is nothing less than just going to sleep and waking up in the presence of this omniscient, omnipresent, and omnipotent God. But now the fourth stanza. And this fourth stanza is so radically different, some Bible teachers even believe that it was not part of the psalm originally. But I would disagree because there's no manuscript to indicate that it was not always a part of Psalm 139. And in a real sense, this emphasis upon the omnicompetent God naturally flows from what we've just seen in verses 1 through 19. One man said that you could call these final verses, this last stanza, a dangerous prayer. You say, why? Because our great God is a good God, but He's also a just God. He is a righteous God. Nothing is beyond His knowledge. Nothing is beyond His presence. Nothing is beyond His power. And indeed, because of that, He is an omnicompetent God. And now what David does is he applies his omnicompetency to the moral order. And David notes in stark contrast the heart and the mind of those who oppose God and are His enemies, verse 22. And then he sets in opposition those who seek God and are His children in verses 23 and 24. In other words, he once more wants to remind us that our Lord knows everything that is going on with each and every one of us, both the good and also the bad. Now, we've not talked about this until this particular time, and so just very quickly, what you have in these verses and what we will see even in our study next week in Psalm 141 is what is called a psalm of imprecation or an imprecatory psalm. It is poetic language where the psalmist asks God to do great harm to those who stand in opposition to God, His righteousness, His plans, and His purposes. You have to keep in mind it's poetic. We're going to see next week that in Psalm 141, he says, throw them off the cliffs and let their bones be scattered so that they don't even receive a decent burial. I mean, that is very harsh language. And in the culture of the ancient world, that would have been a shocking thing. It would have been a sign of God's curse that their bones were not even buried. And so keep in mind that David is writing poetically. Furthermore, keep in mind, David does not say, I will take things into my own hands. David says, God, this is what I will ask you to do. But as you note at the end of the psalm, David recognizes his own sinfulness, his own wickedness. And so he says, Lord, at the same time, make sure you search out my heart as well. And make sure you inspect me as well. So what can we say as we move to this last stanza? Well, first of all, our God will deal with the wicked. Verse 19, oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Indeed, I wish that they would depart from me, these bloodthirsty men, these men of bloodshed. Why? Because they speak against you wickedly. These enemies take your name in vain, and so I hate them, O Lord, who hate you, and I loathe those who rise up against you. I hate them with a perfect hatred. I count them as my enemies. David notes that these men are evil in their actions. Verse 19. These men are evil in their words. Verse 20. These men are evil in their agenda. Verse 21. Sounds a whole lot like the God who knows everything in the first six verses, knows everything in these verses as well. And these men are enemies of David because they are the enemies of God. Here in this context, the word hate has the idea of rejecting, of opposing. Certainly, emotions are involved, but more than that, David is giving us a volitional, reasoned response. He is asking God to deal with these men in judgment in the same kind of way God will deal in judgment at the end of time. Go read the book of Revelation. And what God does there pales in comparison the words of David. David's words are nothing compared to the awesome acts of judgment that you find at the hand of God in the Revelation. John Piper, being a pastor, knows that these are texts that are hard for us to sometimes grasp and comprehend. And so listen to what he says about these imprecatory psalms. I think this will help you. It certainly helped me. There's a kind of hate for the sinner that may coexist with pity and even a desire for their salvation. For example, you may hate spinach without opposing its good use. But there may also come a point when wickedness is so persistent, high-handed, and God-despising that the time of redemption is past and there only remains irremediable wickedness and judgment. Therefore, we will grant to the psalmist, usually David, who speaks under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, and who foreshadows the Messiah as judge, we will grant to him the right to call down judgment on the enemies of God. This is not personal vindictiveness. It is a prophetic execution of what will happen at the last day when God casts all his enemies into the lake of fire. We would do well then to leave such final assessments to God and realize our own corrupt inability to hate as we ought. And so it's not surprising to me that David says, yes, God, deal with the wicked, but in closing, God, lead the humble. What does he say there at the end of the text? Search me, O God, verse 23. Know my heart. Try me and know my anxiety. See if there's any wicked way in me and lead me in the way everlasting. Four verbs catch our eyes, do they not? Search me, try me, see me, lead me. Search. It's the same word that we found back in verse 1. Lord, search me out, inside out. Know the secrets of my soul. Try. The word means to test, like a refiner would test metal. The anxieties, what the NIV calls the anxious thought, speaks, I believe, of the motives and the attitudes of the heart. So he's asking, Lord, do deep introspection into my soul. Wicked way could be translated grievous way. Literally, it is the way of pain. It's the idea of pain resulting from wrong attitudes and wrong actions. It is the way of pain that ultimately leads to suffering and death. And David says, God, I don't want a life like that. In contrast, I want a life that is everlasting. I want a life that leads to the way everlasting. I want a different kind of life. And I believe that David came to understand that for God to do that kind of thing in your life, He has to inspect you. He has to search you. He has to know you. And yes, He even has to wound you. I've heard it said all my life. I believe it's true. Those that God uses greatly, He almost always wounds greatly as well. So let's conclude. What can we take away from this psalm tonight that will gladden our hearts and give us the perspective that David wishes for us to have? I'll just note them very quickly. They're right there in your notes. Number one, even before you were conceived in your mother's womb, your Lord had designed your size, your shape, and the specific makeup of your body and your soul. With the precision of a skilled artisan, He made you exactly as you are for His purposes and His glory. Two, at birth and throughout all of life, there are no surprises or accidents in God's eyes. Now, let that sink into your heart. Some of you have had things happen to you that you wonder, Lord, what was going on? What was that all about? I don't understand it. I can't explain it. It hurt me so deeply. You must have been on vacation on that particular day. You certainly must not have been paying attention. No, at birth, God sees the birth defects. God sees the child born blind. God sees the child born with spina bifida. God sees it all from birth and throughout all of life. No surprises, no accidents. Each and every day was ordained and planned by Him and written down in His day planner for each of us. Again, all this was designed for our ultimate good and His great glory, even if we can't explain it. Three, from the moment we are conceived to the last breath of life, there is no such thing as fate, fortune, luck, or coincidence. The sovereign God who made us is the sovereign God who planned out our life as well. He planned our beginning and our end and everything in between. Four, the fact that we've been made and ordained by this omniscient, omnipresent, and omnipotent God should remind us that nothing we do is hidden from Him. And nothing we do can ultimately overcome His plan. Finally, we are fearfully and wonderfully made by an awesome and wonderful God. He knows me, He is with me, and He made me. Unlike the wicked who are His enemies, I will choose to worship Him and be His friend. Even better, I will devote my life to Him and become His child and He my Father. Heavenly Father, thank You so much for this psalm that is absolutely breathtaking in its scope and magnificent in its content. And I feel so inadequate again for having sought to teach through it tonight. I studied it hard and it has so blessed me. And yet I come away thinking You have just skimmed the surface. You haven't even come close to getting all of the incredible truth that is here. And I acknowledge that. And yet, Lord, I thank you for what you have taught me, and I pray that you have likewise encouraged my brothers and sisters tonight, and that indeed we will stand in awe of the God who is everywhere present, who knows everything, who can do everything, and who will deal with everyone. And we praise your name that you have dealt with us in grace and mercy through Jesus. And we thank you that when you made us in our mother's womb, you made us exactly like you wanted us, for our good and for your glory. And we thank you, Lord, that all the days of our lives have been written in your book, and we are indeed immortal until our work on earth is finished. So, Lord, may we be about your business and about doing your work, knowing that you have foreordained it, you have planned it out, again, for our good and your glory. We claim that promise this evening, making it in the wonderful and strong name of Jesus, our Lord. Amen. God bless you. We'll see you next Wednesday night.